This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, everybody. This is Gary Clinton, and we're about to start off with episode 99 of Night Transmissions. For the opening show, we're going to go to the very successful, very worthwhile, old-time radio series, Suspense, a show that began on July the 22nd of 1940 with an episode on a program called Forecast. This was a show that premiered pilot episodes of new series and then would begin its weekly broadcast on July the 17th of 1942 with this show. An episode based on John Dixon Carr's classic tale that combines hints of the supernatural with an impossible murder. John Dixon Carr, who was born on November the 30th of 1906, and died on February the 27th of 1977, was and remains famous for the ingenious locked room mystery. The Burning Court was adapted for radio by Harold Medford of the Suspense writing staff, and stars Charles Ruggles, who was a well-known comedic actor of the time, who is well and successfully out of type for this episode.
Tonight's presentation is one of the finest of the contemporary stories of mystery and terror. John Dixon Carr's famous novel, The Burning Court.
Ah, a glass of sherry by the fireside of a beautiful suburban home. What could be more comforting? You're an admirable host, Mr. Depas, and it's really a shame our first meeting is under such a cloud. It's also a shame I have so little time to tell you which one of your guests here murdered your uncle last week. Now, let's see now. I believe we're all here. Your wife, your friend, Mr. Stevens, Captain Brennan.
Yes, and incidentally, yourself. Just who did you say you were?
Well, no wonder you've had so much difficulty with the case, Captain. My name is Cross, Gordon Cross, the writer. As a matter of fact, it's because of my just completed book, Poisoning Throughout the Ages, that I happen to be here now. And Ted Stevens there happens to be a member of the firm which publishes my work. I'd never seen him until tonight, but I've been told what happened. This afternoon, he began reading my manuscript for the first time on the train. The commuter's train, which every afternoon deposits him safely and soundly here in Crispin. I imagine he was halfway home by the time he finished the first chapter. Then he turned a page. Attached to the following leaf was a picture. And looking at it, the young man stiffened suddenly and all but cried out his shock. It was a picture of a young woman. And under it had been printed, Famous Poisoner Marie Dobre, 1676. Ted Stevens was looking at a picture of his own wife. Imagine his 25-year-old wife in 17th century costume. The face, the features, even a wistfulness of expression were identical. Even the name. Dobre was his wife's maiden name. But no, that was ridiculous. This woman in the picture was, well, one of his wife's ancestors. Yes, that was it. Simply an amazing family resemblance. Marie would be waiting for him at the station, and he'd have to tell her about it. He wondered why, however, she'd never told him about. Oh, well, but you don't discuss such an ancestor, do you? Ted Stevens glanced down at the chapter to which the picture had been attached. It was entitled, The Affair of the Non-Dead Woman.
Hello, Ted.
Stevens was almost jolted from his seat. It was Dr. Weldon, professor of English at the college, an old friend of his. Quickly, he thrust the picture beneath the manuscript and moved over.
I didn't see you, Doc. Oh, here, have a seat.
Oh, I thought maybe you were giving me the, what do they call it? The brush off?
Oh, no, I... Say, as a matter of fact, Doc, you're the one man I do want to see.
Yeah? Very flattering.
Remember those discussions we used to have about murders?
Better than bridge any time.
Well, I got the idea that you'd made sort of a hobby out of the old cases, the historical ones.
Well, I've studied quite a number of them, yes.
Ever hear of a woman named Marie Dobray?
Marie Dobray? Marie Dobray. Oh, yes. That was her maiden name, of course. One of the finest specialists in arsenic poisoning you could ever hope to find. Oh, we're almost at our station, Ted. Let's get to the door. Yes, a real charmer, Marie was. Must have disposed of 50 husbands, lovers, suitors, and just plain friends before she was caught.
What happened to her, Doc?
She was beheaded and burned.
Crispin!
Oh, absurd. Laughable. Ted Stevens kept saying this to himself, and yet what he knew was a foolish dread followed him straight through the small suburban station and clung to him as he reached the street. And there in the roadster was Marie, leaning toward him a little to hold the door open and smiling at him.
Oh, Ted, what on earth are you staring at?
That street light shining on your hair. I like that.
Oh, you're tight. Come on, get in the car.
Then, like a wisp of smoke, it was gone. The whole ridiculous fear, the delusion. When at home, Marie brought the cocktails into the living room. The logs were burning brightly in the fireplace, throwing a soft, dancing glow upon a room that was darkening with dusk. To you, Marie.
And to you, dear.
As Stevens placed his glass down, he noticed the manuscript of my book. It was there on the table, right where he placed it when he first came in. Deliberately, he turned from it, and then turned back. The manuscript had been moved. Only an inch or so, but it had been moved. Keeping his back to his wife, he thrummed through that early chapter and discovered, just as he knew he would, that the photograph was gone. For a long moment, he thought of what to do. Then slowly, he turned around.
This book by Cross I brought home.
Yes?
There was a story of a poisoner in it. Rather funny. Her name happens to be the same as yours. Oh, your maiden name, that is.
Oh, that is odd, isn't it?
Darling, was she a relative of yours?
Why, Ted, you're serious.
In a way, yes. Oh, I don't mean it's really important. It's just that... Well, when you run across a person who's a dead ringer for your own wife and who lived 300 years ago and was a top-flight poisoner, well, you'd like to hear about it, that's all.
What on earth are you talking about?
Darling, be honest with me. Didn't you look at this manuscript when I was out of the room?
No.
You didn't take out a picture of a poisoner named Marie Dobray?
I most certainly did not. Oh, Ted, what is this all about? What are you getting at?
Oh, just this. Somebody took that picture out of that manuscript since I'd been home. Now, who's that? Well, I'll take a look. Wait, I don't feel like... Why, it's Mark Depard.
Mark? Ted, wait a second.
Yes?
Ted, whatever it is he wants, promise you won't do it.
Promise I won't do
it? I mean, promise you won't get yourself involved. Please, Ted, don't go out tonight.
Say, what in the world is... Well, anyway, we can't let him stay outside. Mark, how are you? Come on in.
Thanks, Ted.
Just thinking about giving you a call later.
Oh, let me have your hat.
No, thanks. I
Marie, I hope you'll excuse me for popping in like this, but, well, I wanted to talk to Ted. It's rather important.
Well, I don't mind at all.
Come on, Mark, we'll step into the library. Oh, you mind, dear?
Of course not, Ted. I'll be licking the sandwiches for her.
Oh, grab that chair in the corner, Mark. Well, let's hear it.
What's the trouble?
Ted, my Uncle Miles was murdered.
Murdered?
Oh, the talk hasn't reached you yet, but it's already started. Nothing definite, of course, just that there was something wrong about Uncle Miles' death.
But I don't... Mark, are you sure of this? You know he was murdered?
I don't know. Of course I don't. I just don't see how it could be any other way. Uncle Miles, you know, had been sick for quite a while, but last Saturday he seemed so much better that Miss Corbett, that was his nurse, decided to take the day off. And, oh, you know all this. You and Marie were over that afternoon. Anyway, Lucy and I went to the club that night, to that masquerade party, and we left the old boy completely alone. I've cursed myself 1,000 times since.
But what about your housekeeper, Mrs., what's her name? Henderson. Wasn't she around?
Oh, sure. In that little house out in back. We told her to look in now and then, but, well, that wasn't good enough. It was after midnight when Lucy and I got back. Uncle Miles was dying. Ted, it looked exactly like one of his regular attacks. But then later, after he was gone, I happened to glance under the chest of drawers in his room. There was a small silver cup under there, almost drained, and Uncle Miles' cat. The cat was still warm, but quite dead.
Oh.
I managed to get the cat out of the house and buried without anyone seeing me. Next day, I had the contents of the cup analyzed.
It was poison?
Yes. Arsenic.
Well, what do you want me to do?
Help me open the crypt.
What?
I want to have a private autopsy performed. Help me get Uncle Miles' body out of that vault. Oh, I know it's a tough job. The thing is sealed solid, but we can do it.
You mean without the police knowing about it?
Without anybody knowing about it. Mrs. Henderson's visiting her sister, and I managed to send Lucy over to the club.
You must be crazy. You're playing with dynamite, Mark. This is something you've got to tell the police now.
I can't take that chance.
But they'll have to know sometime. You're only
I've got to know first, I tell you. You don't understand, Ted. There was somebody in Uncle Miles' room that night. Handing him something in a silver cup. Mrs. Henderson was on the porch by the window. She saw her.
She saw her?
Ted. She thinks it was my wife.
Oh, Lucy.
It doesn't mean anything to Mrs. Henderson yet, because she doesn't suspect anything. But, well, Ted, you've got to see why I've got to be sure. Why I've got to know how Uncle Miles died. Because it wasn't Lucy, Ted. I know it wasn't.
Of course not, Mark. She had an alibi. Well, she was with you at the club, wasn't she?
Yes. Except for half an hour.
I see.
You will help me, won't you, Ted?
When do we start?
As soon as you can make it.
Okay. Come on now, I'll get your hat. You trot on ahead and I'll come over as soon as I can see Marie.
But you're not going to tell her about this.
Of course not. I'll think of something. Don't you worry about it.
No, thanks, Ted. Thanks a lot.
Marie?
I'm coming.
Darling, Mark asked me to...
I know, Ted. Here. You better take your sandwiches with you. You'll be hungry.
But... You knew I was going out?
Yes, I knew.
You listened to us?
I couldn't help it, Ted. I had no idea what Mark's visit was about. The talk about his uncle's death. There's a lot of gossip about it in the village. That's why I tried to tell you. Why, I didn't want you to get mixed up in it. But it's too late now, isn't it? I mean, you're going. I can tell by the way you look. Ted, wait a second. There's just one thing I want to tell you before you leave. And that is that... No matter what happens, no matter what you find or think or believe, I love you. You'll remember that, won't you?
I'll remember you said so, Marie.
By the light of a dim kerosene lantern, Mark and Ted Stevens pounded their way through the thick shelf of rock that covered the DePars ancestral tomb. Pried open the great slab of stone which lay across the subterranean door, and then at last descended to the dank, ink-black chamber. They found the coffin. They dragged it from its crypt and placed it on the cold stone floor. They unclamped the lid and opened it.
Mark!
It's empty.
What? That's impossible. It can't be.
But it is, Mark. You know what this means? That body wasn't in this coffin when it was placed here.
I'll swear it was, Ted.
From the time that coffin was closed on Uncle Miles, somebody, the Undertaker or Lucy or me, somebody was with it until it was buried. And the crypt was sealed right after.
Then somebody beat us to it. Somebody's broken in here ahead of us.
Broken in? Listen, Ted. Lucy and I have hardly left the house since the funeral. Do you think anybody could break in here? Smash through that stone and cement without our seeing them or without our hearing them?
Well...
What?
Well, you might as well come on out then.
But who was that?
Me, Mr. Despard, up here. My name's Captain Brennan. I'm from the office of the Commissioner of Police.
From the...
Like to talk to you if you don't mind, Mr. Despard. Here, follow my flashlight up.
But I don't understand. How did you know about this?
By listening, mainly. Do you mind if we go up to your house, Mr. Despard?
Why, no. Not at all.
Oh, thank you. Oh, Freddy.
Look here, Captain.
Freddy, this is Mr. Despard, Lieutenant Gray.
Glad to know you, Mr. Despard.
And Mr. Ted Stevens, isn't it?
Well, how did you know my name?
Very simple. I got the names of everybody who was here at the Despard's the day the old man died. You and your wife were included. Oh, here we are.
But I don't... Captain, who gave you those names?
Why, your housekeeper, of course.
Mrs. Henderson?
You didn't think Mrs. Henderson saw the dead cat, did you, Mr. Despard? But she did. She also saw you bury it. And we've been interested in the case ever since. Well, nice place you have here, Mr. Despard. Now, let's see. According to Mrs. Henderson, your wife was wearing some kind of a masquerade costume that night. What kind of a thing was it?
Well, it was... there, you can see it. It was copied from the dress in that old painting over there.
Oh, yes. Funny. Well, where's the woman's face?
It's always been that way, long as I can remember. Somebody must have thrown acid on it or something. Can't blame them much. She was a poisoner.
A poisoner?
Yes. The story goes that one of my ancestors was responsible for her execution. Marie Dobray, her name was.
Oh, yes. I've read about her. Learned all the poison tricks from one of her lovers, a guy by the name of Godin St. Croix.
Godin St.
Oh, yes, Mr. Stevens. We cops read now and then.
Did you say Godin St. Croix?
That's French. We call it cross. Absolutely no limit to a cop's education, is there? But to get back to your wife, Mr. Despard, she was dressed like the famous Marie. Now, when Mrs. Henderson looked through that window...
Just a minute, Captain. Mrs. Henderson can't prove she saw a thing, and you know it.
What do you mean?
I mean you haven't any right to insinuate that my wife was in that room.
Well, who's insinuating? I'm trying to say that Mrs. Henderson, after thinking it over, realizes she was tricked by the costume. The woman she saw in the funny clothes, handing the cup of poison to your uncle, wasn't your wife at all.
What?
Because your wife is an unusually tall young woman, and the one Mrs. Henderson saw was fully half a head shorter. More on the order, let's say, of Mr. Stevens' wife.
My wife?
Captain, this is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I don't know. Why, what's the matter, Mr. Stevens? You're traveling like a leaf. Tell me now, just for fun, where was Mrs. Stevens that night?
She was home, with me.
The whole evening?
Certainly.
She retired early?
Yes, we both did.
You, I suppose, were sound asleep by midnight.
Yes, I was.
Then how do you know where your wife was?
Well,
Look here, Stevens. She had to have a costume that would match Mrs. Despard's. How did she manage that? Where did she get it?
Well, she never had one. She never had a dress like that.
And what about our motive? Why did she poison him?
I don't know.
Not for money, certainly. Then what was it? Hate? Did she hate Miles Despard?
Yes, she did. Oh,
no!
Oh, I don't know. I don't know, I tell you.
Rob?
Yes, Freddy?
I phoned and got hold of Mrs. Despard, the nurse, all right. That Mrs. Stevens couldn't reach her. Her phone won't answer.
Okay, have her picked up.
I'm going home.
Stevens, come back here.
I'm going to get my wife.
A minute, stop it, Brennan. Let's go.
Marie, where are you? It's Ted. Marie, what have you done? Maria! Oh,
good evening.
Who are you?
I? My name is Cross, Godin Cross.
Cross? Where's my wife? What have you done to her? You fiend, what have you done to my wife?
Why, nothing at all, young man. Here, sit down.
You're lying. Something's happened to her. The police just phoned. There wasn't an answer. Why are you here?
Why am I here? Well, because your wife, reading my chapter on the Dobrays, realized I knew more about the family than even she did. Because she found my phone number on the front cover of the manuscript. And because I know an exceptional case when I hear one. Does that answer your question?
No, and you know it doesn't. Can't you see I've got to know whether...
Yeah, I see. Whether your wife is that Marie Dobre, who was burnt. Burnt by order of the High Tribunal for all poison cases. The burning court of France. Witchcraft, black magic. The world across the threshold. You're quite sure, no doubt, also, that I'm Gaudin Sainte Croix, who first wooed her. No, no, my boy. No, my real name happens to be, of all things, Tom Simpson. Most unsuitable for a distinguished writing career. And Marie Dobre is no more your wife's real name than mine is Gaudin Cross.
What?
Your esteemed wife was an adopted child, Mr. Stevens. Adopted by people in Canada named Dobre. Remote members of the real family of poisoners.
I can't believe it. Why? Why didn't she tell me?
Why? Because until I told her half an hour ago, she didn't know it herself. You see, in the course of my research on the family, I found out about it. And in the course of talking with your wife, I found out something else. How for years she was haunted by the fear that she might be a poisoner by inheritance, by blood. And you can see, can't you, why she never talked about it? Her past to you?
Yes, yes.
And yet, Mr. Stevens, you had all but made her forget that past. You. And that's why she was willing to lie, to steal a picture, do anything, in order to hold you to her.
Yes, yes, I see that now.
You know, young man, I rather think she loves you. But as you will see, though, she comes only when I call her. Mrs. Stevens?
You mean she's...
Yes, Mr. Cross.
Marie, it's you. You're all right?
Oh, yes, dear. We're both all right now, and nothing can change it, ever.
Marie, listen.
Don't say Marie, dear. Say Maggie.
Maggie?
Well, that's my name, my real name. Maggie McTavish. And it's a lovely name, dear. The most beautiful, gorgeous...
Darling, ever. Darling, please. You don't understand. The police, they think you had something to do with Miles' death.
They think I did?
So, now, Mr. Stevens, before we go back to the DeBars, don't you think you'd better tell me everything that's been said and done up to date? Having just saved your wife's soul from the burning court... Now I'll rest her body from the electric chair. Yes, Mr. DePauw, truly excellent sherry. Don't you think so, Miss Corbett?
Yes. Yes, it's very nice.
Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is how I happen to be here. So let us consider first that supernatural hocus-pocus in the crypt. That body that walked out of the sealed tomb. That body that never was in the tomb.
Never was in the tomb?
No, Mr. DePauw. The murderer knew that very soon Mrs. Henderson's story would bring about an investigation. He had to get rid of the well-known corpus delicti.
Yes, but who could have kept the body out of the tomb?
Who, Mr. DePauw? Why, you, sir.
What? I don't understand.
Well, it's very simple. You had the opportunity. I believe you said yourself you were alone with the body before the burial. And you had the strength... I dare say you carried it down to the furnace, where it's now probably nothing but ashes.
Ridiculous. Why would he spend an hour smashing into a crypt for a body he knew wasn't there?
Why, Captain? To impress Mr. Stevens, his witness, and also apparently you.
Oh, that's perfectly fantastic.
Fantastic? Oh, no, Lucy. Just comic. And I suppose, Mr. Cross, that I also put on a woman's masquerade costume, went into my uncle's room and handed him a nice cup of arsenic.
No, no, no. That had to be done by a woman. Your accomplice, as a matter of fact... Oh, now, come. You mustn't all look at Mrs. DePauw, because Mark DePauw's one noble act was his frantic effort to prevent his wife from being charged with the crime. A crime which he and nurse Myra Corbett committed.
Myra Corbett?
Why, you...
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Stevens, this quiet little lady beside me.
Why would I do such a thing?
Money, Miss Corbett. A cutout of Mark DePauw's inheritance. Payments for services rendered.
That's an absolute lie, Cross.
You see, ladies and gentlemen, Captain Brennan never bothered to check Miss Corbett's whereabouts on the night of the murder. Why even think of the nurse? She was the custodian of the old man's health.
Oh, you're crazy. You're crazy.
And yet who but a nurse could so naturally offer the old man a cup? A cup he was sure contained medicine.
You're making it up. The whole thing, you're just
and
making it up.
And who but Miss Corbett, living right here in this house, would know what kind of masquerade dress she must copy, would know when Mrs. Henderson would pass the window that night, pass and see her, and accept her, she hoped, for Lucy DePauw.
No! That's not true.
Oh, yes, Miss Corbett. Yes, Miss Corbett, that dress was the touch that wrecked you. That was your own idea, wasn't it? Not Mark's. You weren't content with a mere murderer's share of the profits. You wanted a wife's share, half of the whole estate. You wanted Lucy Depar convicted and out of the way for good. Well, I give you a toast, Miss Corbett, with Mr. Depar's excellent sherry. To a particularly ruthless poisoner. And yet, you know, on the whole, I'm rather partial to female poisoners. Why, only tonight I...
Mr. Cook, what's the matter, Brennan?
This man's dead.
Dead?
And from cyanide, if I know anything. Cyanide from that glass of sherry. Cyanide that a nurse could get quite easily. That glass was right beside you, Miss Corbett, and nobody else was near it. Too bad he didn't drink it as soon as you hoped. A second ago, we had nobody to use against you. But we have now, Miss Corbett. We have now. And I arrest you for the murder of Gordon Cross.
Months ago that the prominent author was murdered, and tonight Myra Corbett pays with her life for that crime. The former nurse, at first protesting her innocence, in recent
years... Yes, I'm in here, dear.
Oh, I thought you might... What did you cut it off for?
Huh? What do you mean?
The radio.
Oh, yeah, well, I thought you wanted to talk.
Poor Ted, don't you think I know you better than that? What was on the radio?
Well, there wasn't any... Okay. It was about Myra Corbett. She goes to the chair tonight.
Oh.
I didn't think you wanted to be reminded.
I don't, really. But making such an effort to hide it only keeps it alive, doesn't it? All right, darling. Know what I came in to ask? If you wanted a cocktail before dinner?
The largest one you've got.
Fine. I'll get out the ice cube.
I know. If I'll fix up the fire. Okay, Maria. A deal. Where are some papers to start it?
Right there by the bookcase. And the name's not Marie. It's Maggie. Because, darling... Marie's dead and gone forever.
Oh, no, Marie. We're never dead. Neither of us. It was your hand that touched that glass. I know that now. And I could return the favor. But instead... I shall ask that you dispatch your husband. This one, like all the others, now. Just a little bit of poison in the drink, Marie. Any kind of a drink.
What kind, Ted?
Hmm?
What kind of a cocktail shall we have?
Oh, any kind, darling. Any kind at all.
You've just heard The Burning Court from John Dixon Carr's famous novel, the first in Columbia's new series of outstanding classics and chills by world-famous authors. Tonight's play, ladies and gentlemen, has one rather special significance we think you'd like to know about. As you perhaps have heard, every fine comedian is said to cherish a secret desire to do an abrupt about-face. He pines for the part of a blackguard. Well, tonight you witness the fulfillment of one such desire. The role of that literary and quite infamous diehard, Gordon Cross, was portrayed by none other than Hollywood's expert provoker of laughs, Charlie Ruggles, here in New York for the world premiere of his latest screen success, Friendly Enemies. The role of Marie, well, that was enacted by a young lady who long ago won national acclaim as one of Broadway's most accomplished dramatic actresses, Miss Julie Hayden. Thank you, Charlie Ruggles and Miss Julie Hayden, for your splendid performances. The play tonight... as all plays in this series, was produced and directed by Charles Vander, written by Harold Medford, and scored by Bernard Herrmann. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Truth is stranger than fiction. This is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not.
The parish clerks of Hungerford, England, for 800 years have visited each household on the second Tuesday after Easter to collect a penny from each man for church repairs and a kiss from each woman, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about the Iron Man.
Yes, sir, life is swell when you keep well. And say what a really swell cereal Post Bran Flakes are. Crisp and crunchy. And what a wonderful nut-like flavor. And then those extra benefits. The benefits of bran so many of you may need to help you keep fit naturally. So why don't you join the millions who enjoy Post Bran Flakes every day for their delicious flavor, for their extra benefits. Yes, life is swell when you keep well.
Sir Thomas Overbury certainly deserves to be called a man of iron. He was imprisoned in the Tower of London and for 3 months and 17 days was fed a daily diet of hemlock, arsenic, nitric acid, ground diamonds, and mercury, enough poison to have killed 20 men. But Sir Thomas refused to die. Finally, an injection of a powerful corrosive killed him. Later, the guards who'd been bribed to poison him were executed. Believe it or not.
There are five or six of these old radio series that I am extremely fond of. The Price of Fear is one of those. It was a horror mystery program produced sporadically by the BBC Radio between 1972 and 1982. And although it was enormously successful in the United Kingdom and abroad, there were, during those 10 years, only 72 episodes made. The show was hosted by and usually starred Vincent Price, Price of Fear, get it? Whose experience in the movies and in radio and television was an effective backdrop for the series. I think helped the series establish its flair in the way that only perhaps a handful of performers could have. Another cool thing, although it's not the case in tonight's show, was that these stories were actually presented as if it had happened to Vincent Price himself. Or if it hadn't happened to him specifically, it had happened to somebody he was close to, and he was on the scene when it happened. Tonight's story, Is There Anyone There? Is maybe not the best example of the Price of Fear, but it's very entertaining.
Hello and welcome. In Arcadia Avenue, the houses have names as well as numbers. Shangri-La, Dunroman, Montrepose. They best sum up the avenue's air of nostalgic gentility. Built in the early 30s, all is very discreetly orthodox, from the privacy of privet hedge and lace curtains at the front to the squares of handkerchief-sized lawn at the back. In later years, however, professional nameplates have appeared on several of the front gateposts. Brigadoon now houses Chetney, Chetney, and Chetney accountants. Dunroman, complete with monkey tree, a veterinary surgeon. Higher up the avenue, there is an establishment for the fitting of ladies' foundation garments. But it is to the recently renamed Celestina that our attention must finally turn. The first thing one notices is that its brass nameplate is somewhat grimier than the others. It pronounces Miss Griselda Thorpe to be medium and clairvoyant, consultations and ministrations strictly by appointment only. Every Wednesday afternoon, promptly at 3 o'clock, Mr. Henry Jollett climbs the gravel path, presses the front door bell button, and anticipates, at the going rate of 1 guinea per session, yet another preview of eternity.
Ah, my dear Mr. Jollett.
Miss Edith, I trust I'm not premature.
No, 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 quite the contrary. Punctual to the very second as usual.
Punctuality, my dear Mr. Jollett, the prerogative of kings. In my books, whatever, or anybody else's for that matter. Edith!
Yes, Griselda?
Stop catching blue bottles. Assist me with the sacred pendant.
Yes, Griselda. I can't quite see.
Fingers and thumbs, fingers and thumbs. There. Mr. Jollett, drill as before, if you please. You there, in the hot seat.
Thank you.
I shall sit here, with my back to the window. Better for vibes and less chance of spiritual dispersion, don't you know? And Edie, you... Edie, where have you got to?
Yeah, Griselda, I've been here all along. Really, I have.
But I don't want you here, dear. I want you there, in the third chair.
Of course. How silly. There. You can begin now, Griselda.
Thank you, dear. We will join hands in a circle of eternal light and harmony.
Well, do it as though you meant it, woman, for heaven's sake. Hands, harmony. The man's not a flat fish.
Oh, yes, Griselda.
Peace. Perfect peace. Peace. Perfect peace. Peace.
It started, Mr. Jonnet. You can always tell when it started.
Are you there? Are you there, oh mighty Manco Capac, Emperor of the Inca, beloved of the sun?
Her spirit guide, you know.
I have had the pleasure.
Speak, oh mighty one. Is there anybody there?
He's there.
Speak. Speak.
It is I, Manco Capac, Emperor of the Inca, beloved of the sun, God living, God incarnate, God of the infinite orb.
This is where her breathing gets heavier. You'll see.
Speak. Oh, Manco Capac, Emperor of your peoples, spirit guide to lesser mortals bound in bonds of common clay.
Above the land of Cuzco, the condor flies high in search of the lamb that has strayed.
Oh, dear.
Our fields lie fallow, our storehouses empty. The living seed of promise has burnt itself to hash.
I don't like the sound of that at all.
Prepare then, my people. Prepare ye. Climb, oh, climb thy temple mountain. Anoint with sacred unctions this, our human sacrifice. See, oh, see where the living god of the orb, the chariot of the sun, spins gold upon this holy place. Raise high the sacred blade. The time of the living blood is upon us. The time is now. Now!
Edith. Stop daydreaming and pass Mr. Jollett the last of those chocolate digestives.
Oh, yes. Mr. Jollett?
No, thank you, Miss Edie.
Oh, well. Piggy to the trough? I'll have it. But Edie, while you're on your feet, you can put Capac's sacred pendant back in the casket where it belongs.
There. Beautiful, isn't it, Mr. Jollett?
Beautiful. Quite beautiful.
I'd let you take a closer peek, but I don't think the old boy would go for that. Even letting Edie get her chocolatey little paws on it is stretching the point. But at least in the family, if you take my meaning.
Of course.
Oh, at least let me top you up.
I beg your pardon? No, thank you. It's most kind.
Ah, downhearted. I don't blame you. 3 Wednesdays in a row and still no contact with the dear departed, eh?
Not yet, Griselda. The Emperor did seem to have rather a lot on his mind.
Oh? I rely on Edie to keep me in the picture, you know.
Huh?
Have to, don't I, old thing? Once his nibs takes over, out of my hands. Everything up to him, and when it's all over, the old memory slate wiped clean. Just like it had never happened.
But you must have some idea.
Griselda did try getting it on tape. in the early days.
Shrine's the word.
Oh?
Not a sausage. First couple of times, just put it down to Sister Edie making her usual bosh of it.
Griselda!
Well, not exactly of a mechanical bent, old thing, let's face it. If she ever got around to fixing a fuse, she'd probably blow up Battersea Power Station.
Griselda. So, what happened?
Happened? Nothing. Funny thing about it, though, all the early stuff, us getting settled, the odd bit of traffic noises from the avenue, Edie's ridiculous asides, all clear as a bell. But the minute Manco Capac starts doing his stuff, nothing.
Perhaps you were too far off the microphone.
No further than any of the others. And from what Edie tells me, his Nibs is not exactly the sotto voce type.
Not exactly.
Still, 3 weeks on the trot and still no contact with the dear departed. If he doesn't pull his finger out soon, you'll be asking for your lolly back.
Oh, dear lady, it never entered my mind.
Odd, though.
Odd?
Don't have many failures, do we, Edie, old thing?
The first I can remember, Griselda.
If your dear departed wife...
Violet, Griselda.
Violet, quite. Well, old Manco Capac can usually be relied upon to winkle them out. Not that there'd be much persuading needed, mind you.
Huh?
Well, put yourself in Violet's place. Like being told there's a long-distance phone call. Not even bothering to find out who's on the other end.
I'd never quite thought of it in that light.
I wonder what light you had thought of it in, Mr. Jollett.
I notice you've been admiring my sister's portrait, Mr. Jollett.
What? Oh, yes, yes. It had rather caught my eye.
Splendid, isn't it?
Edie.
Oh, but it is, Griselda, dear. Such an excellent likeness.
Give or take 20 years.
Oh, such fire. Such expression.
Indeed.
Cleopatra, don't you know?
Oh, really?
Not the old Vic, Mr. Jollett. Finsbury Park Empire. What they call in the business a bum week. Not the title role, either. Though that's clearly the impression my sister wishes to give.
Oh, but...
Patata-tita. Patata-tita, patata-tita, patata-tita. Trusted and rather boring handmaiden to the Queen, don't you know? She's the one that brings that awful rubber snake on at the end. The trickiest part was getting the name right. Patata-tita. I still have nightmares.
Painted by a fellow artiste, Mr. Jollett.
Better at painting than acting. But then everybody in the company seemed better at something than acting.
Of course, I had realized your background was probably theatrical.
Only probably. Oh, my dear man, such understatement.
That isn't to imply...
The ham of all hams. Always was, always will be. Why, I eventually had the good sense to give it up. Anyway, 20 years on, water under the bridge. And sure, you must have better things to do than gawp at pathetic shortcomings of an aspiring Sarah Bernhardt.
How interesting.
Mr. Jollett?
How very interesting. 20 years. You did say 20 years.
Give or take. Why do you ask?
In the painting, you're already wearing the sacred pendant.
Am I? Yes. Yeah, so I am, aren't I?
Griselda's feeling of being caught out did not escape either Edie's or Mr. Jollett's notice. To begin with, Griselda half-choked on her chocolate digestive, then lapsed into a granite-like silence, which made the gentleman shift uneasily on the edge of his seat, drop a spoon, and finally invent a previous engagement, and so beat a grateful retreat.
Griselda, what are you doing?
What does it look as though I'm doing? I am having myself a gin.
But you've just had tea.
They can fight it out between them.
Griselda.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to have 3 gins.
But isn't it a little early to
From
start?
Where I'm standing, it might already be a damn sight too late. Well, why the hell don't you join me?
No, thank you.
Suit yourself. Oh. Own damned fault.
Pardon?
Should have cottoned on to the blighter long before this. I must be losing my grip. Was a time I'd have got his number before he got his size 10s over the front door, Matt.
Are you referring to our Mr. Jollett?
Jollett. Jollett. I wonder how long it took him to dream that one up. Or perhaps he super-duper pulled it from a hat.
Super-duper?
Superintendent, dear.
What?
Police. Fuzz. Oh, God knows why I didn't tumble. What did he say that ridiculous wife's name was again?
Violet.
Violet Jolliet. Well, have you ever heard anything more unlikely? Who in their right mind would ever want to be supernaturally reunited with someone called Violet Jolliet?
Mr. Jolliet.
Hocus pocus, pudding and pie. Not that she ever existed, but like somebody opening the second half in old-time music hall.
Oh.
Violet Jolliet and her performing love doves. Osprey feather at the tent and her feathered friends dropping bird muck all over her velveteen and diamante ball gown. Not to mention half the stalls.
I'm still not sure I follow you, Griselda.
Well, God knows how much clearer I can make it. Phony, through and through.
Ah, Mr. Jolliet.
And for God's sake, stop calling him that.
And Mrs. Jolliet, too.
Well, how else was he going to get himself over the front door?
Oh, but if our Mr... Well, the gentleman isn't what he pretends.
I thought I put you in the picture. He's either one of the plainclothes brigade or
a hack.
A hack? A scribbler.
A scribbler?
From one of those dreadful Sunday rags, all turge and true confession.
Well, he doesn't look like a newspaper man.
You've never seen a newspaper man.
No.
Well, then, they're not all trilby hats and dirty trench coats, you know.
No, I suppose they can't be.
Still, had it coming.
Had what coming?
On the cards. That one day I'd probably get myself splashed right across the front page of one of the Sunday dreadfuls. Real life expose. Life after death racket. The sinister truth. You know the kind of thing. One of those dreadful photographs they always find to go with it. Out of focus and slightly blurred around the edges.
Griselda, dear, it wouldn't be true anyway, would it?
So what the devil do you think I've been prattling on about? The big phony. Always knew it, so now it's out of the bag. Good run for our money. Our money, Sister Edie, but over.
I don't believe you.
Then turn a blind eye again. Your option. Always been your prerogative in the past.
Oh, true.
Always true. Turn a blind eye to whatever you can't take. For you and Mumsy and dear dead Papa. The whole ridiculous charade of Arcadia Avenue. Over. Done with. Kaput. Thank God.
Your spiritual gift.
Phony as hell.
If you made it all up.
All of it.
Not Manco Capac.
It had a ring about it. Not the kind of thing they'd be likely to find in the telephone directory.
But I heard him, Griselda. Your spirit voice.
A fair stab at one, even if I do say so myself. First tried it out when I was playing one of the three witches in the Scottish play. Closed after three nights. Theatre Royal Hanley. Little did I know years later it might still have its uses. By the way, did you notice how your Mr. Jolliet turned somersaults when he heard of my theatrical associations? It must always be a bit of a giveaway, I suppose.
He was admiring the pendant, Griselda. Pendant of the Emperor Manco Capac, ruler of the Incas, from out of the land of Cusco.
Spirit guide of lesser mortals, bound in the bond of common clay.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, old girl. Bosh. All bosh. God knows where I even picked up that worthless bit of scrap iron. Probably with the rest of the junk in one of those sixpenny trays.
I see.
Edie?
No. Just a bit of a headache. An early night. I'll take one of my pills. Well, perhaps even two.
What about your Biddy Buys cocoa?
No, thank you, dear.
I don't feel much like it tonight. No, not tonight.
We have no way of knowing how long it was before Griselda followed Edie up the wooden hill. Gin had always been her tipple. It not only relaxed her, it gave her a warm feeling of righteous self-pity. And if she wasn't entitled to a large slice of that tonight, who the devil was? She could have been asleep for hours. She might just have closed her eyes. She lay fully clothed on top of the bed. She was perfectly aware of the distant town hall clock and that damn Ginger Tom making its caterwauling next door. She was cold, reached down to pull the heavy eiderdown about her, but her hands lacked the strength, her intention, the purpose. She was pinioned, but not only by physical force, as though by hypnotism, behind her eyes, dragging her backwards through time, place, to a scene she seemed to know, recognize, as in a dream. But a dream that was about to become her reality.
Hearken then, O sacred children of the sun. Let it be known through our infant land that her denial of us, of our blessed sacred symbol, shall be avenged. Let the time be now. Raise high the sacred blade. The time of the living blood is upon us. The time is now. Now! The heart to be removed. See where it beats even now upon the altar of our forefathers. Even now.
It was always Edie who coped with the ritual of early morning tea. She'd carefully avoid Griselda's pom-pommed carpet slippers, then set the cup gently down on her bedside table, draw her curtains to exactly the width she demanded, and then shake her gently, but firmly, by her shoulder until she got the first grunt of awakening and recognition. But no grunt came. It took Edie a long time before she finally would accept that Griselda was dead.
Edie.
But it's not even Wednesday, Mr. Jollett.
No, it isn't, is it? May I come in?
I don't know. Are you alone?
Of course.
But only for a minute, then. It's a terrible mess. I'd offer you some tea, but I'm not really up to it.
Oh, I quite understand.
Do you?
I only called to offer my sympathy. If there's anything...
How did you find out about my sister's... Miss Griselda's passing?
A small paragraph in last evening's paper.
Oh. But only a small paragraph, you say? Oh, I'm not sure she'd have been too happy about that. Notices, even the obituary kind, were very important to her. Banner headlines, a photograph. A bit out of focus, blurred around the edges, was the way she put it. When I opened the door to you just now, I quite expected popping camera bulbs and a black Mariah. I'd almost hoped for it.
I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, there's really no need to keep up the charade, you know. No need at all. Now, Mr. Jollett.
I see.
Oh, she saw through you all right. Right from the very start. Edie, she said. Edie, dear, the man's an imposter. Jot it. Such a ridiculous name.
Isn't it, though?
There never was a late Mrs. Jollett either, was there?
No.
No. She roared her head off at that. Like somebody opening the second half in old-time music hall. She roared her head off at that.
How else could I have got to see her?
False pretenses.
It was important to me.
So why assume a false identity?
Oh, no, the identity at least was my own. I do have a card.
Professor Henry Jollett.
The letters will mean nothing to you.
The National Institute of History.
Ancient history. South American, to be exact. Specializing in early Incan cultures.
It really means nothing to me, Mr. Jollett.
No.
But, for what it's worth, I'd like you to explain.
Well, where to begin? Just by chance, the wife of an associate put me onto your late sister's activities.
Oh.
Forgive the scepticism. I'd never ventured into the spiritual world, but that didn't prevent me thinking I'd heard it all before. The substitution of an Incan emperor instead of your usual Indian chief gave it a certain twist. But I really had no intention of coming until I found myself here.
Go on.
It wasn't until she summoned the Emperor by name I started to take an interest.
Ah, yes. Her great Manco Capac?
Not exactly the kind of name you find in a telephone directory, is it?
It's why she chose it, Mr. Jollett.
Made it up?
If you like.
Except that she didn't. Manco Capac, the predestined one, founder of the Inca dynasty, bearer of the staff of gold, protector of the family and the hearth, founder of the city called...
Cusco.
Exactly. Well, she could have researched it, of course.
Except that she didn't.
No, she didn't. As I listened to her, there were many details of the emperor, his fort city at Cusco, that no amateur, that even I, after a lifetime of study and only now beginning to alight on, a new world... Long dead, but through her awakening again with a vigor and intensity I could never have aspired to. And yet, I doubted. Right up until...
Until?
The very last time, in this room. We were having tea, and then, out of the corner of my eye, I spotted it. Final proof of all I'd been so stupidly skeptical about.
Her portrait?
And about her neck, the royal seal pendant of the Incas.
You'd seen it before?
Only in the gloom, at a distance, across the table. She'd refused to ever let me handle it. But suddenly, here in her portrait, 20, 30 years earlier, a very competent artist with all the time in the world to capture every detail. Will you permit me to see it? A pendant?
If you wish it. She was wearing it when I found her. The clasp was broken, as though it had been torn from her neck.
The autopsy was a necessary legal formality. In view of her age, excess weight, some kind of heart condition seemed the likeliest bet. In the antiseptic whiteness of their 20th century morgue, they made their preparations. A few know-it-all students jostled for a better view, sniggered at her large whiteness. There were no scars on her body, not even an appendectomy. But when her cadaver was eventually opened, they found no heart, only the severed aorta and the cavity where it had once lain. Miss Edie was offered a fortune for her pendant. She refused to sell it. It's now on permanent loan to Mr. Jollett's museum. She often drops in to see it, and there's usually tea and chocolate digestives in his office afterwards. And she's never taken down that brass nameplate on the gatepost. Consultations and ministrations strictly by appointment only. Whenever her finances get a bit tight, she consoles herself that she can always take up where Griselda left off. And why not? She does have connections in high places.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. And I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. By the way, that Incan emperor that the old lady keeps talking about was a historical personage, founding the kingdom of Cusco around 1200 A.D., which would expand and continue, and yes, change, but exist in one form or another until 1533, when the Europeans arrived, in this case, Francisco Pizarro. And as they did in so many other places with so many other civilizations, just wrecked the party. For the science fiction segment tonight, I have an episode of SF-68. This was a South African broadcast which featured high-caliber adaptations of mostly previously published short stories from generally well-known, well-established science fiction writers, the likes of Bradbury, Ellison, Murray Leinster. And tonight, from somebody who is less well-known, Lee Harding. Before I heard this story, I'd never heard of Lee Harding. It turns out, though, that he was, in some circles, a fairly well-known science fiction writer. Born in Victoria, Australia, on February the 19th of 1937, he has a number of short stories and novels to his credit, pretty much all published in English and Australian magazines. Don't know if he's still alive or not. Wouldn't be that old. Let's see. He's 9 years older than I am. That would make him somewhere around 74. Looking through the bibliography, the last entry I can see for him, though, is a letter that he wrote to the science fiction sort of fan magazine, sort of professional magazine, Locus, which was published in 1981. The story comes from 1968, as do all episodes of SF-68, and is not really quite like anything I've ever read, and I've read a lot of science fiction. It's a social commentary about one man's odyssey looking for something real, anything real. It's very well written, well acted, and well plotted, and fits very well into the category of dystopian literature. The story was originally published in the British science fiction magazine New Worlds for April of 1963. And unfortunately, the quality of the audio in this recording is less than optimal, but I do think it's completely listenable and worth a listen.
SF-68. Something real. Something that hasn't been made by man. Something that isn't synthetic. That's all. Not to keep.
But why do you feel that you must have this something real?
Why, Mr. Divisional Controller? I don't know. I just know that I must, that's all. Something I can hold in my two hands. touch and know that it hasn't been made by man.
By whom then, Mr. Johnson?
By whom? I don't know. I don't know. I just know that I must feel something real that hasn't been made by man. Don't you understand?
SF-68 presents Quest, adapted for radio and produced by Michael McCabe. Quest. Surely you realize that. You must forgive me. I fear that a sudden adverse overload has overworked, you understand? You will be attended to. You will be attended to. You will be attended to. You.
Oh, no. Where? Where can I find something that isn't man-made? Even him. Even my divisional controller's a robot. Was a robot. Let them sort that mess out if they can.
Mr. Johnson, age indeterminate. No one knew their ages anymore. No one knew anything very much anymore. Only their citizen code number, the duties assigned to them at their place of work, and their living quarters index number. Mr. Johnson, small, insignificant. It was a shock to Mr. Johnson, knowing that his trusted divisional controller, the man, the thing that he'd been in the habit of taking all his troubles to, was a robot.
What's happening to the world? Machines that look like people, people who look like machines. Each day it becomes more difficult to tell one from the other.
The town commanded everything. Everything was commanded by the town. The city. Johnson started walking. In no particular direction. Dizzying cliffs of steel rising drunkenly towards the sky. Incredible blocks of artificiality marching doggedly towards infinity.
There must be an end to this city. There must be something real somewhere.
Must, sir. Try the elevators, Johnson. They must go somewhere. Somewhere real? Elevators, yes.
Where to?
Down.
How far?
As far as I can go.
As far as I can go.
As far as you can go.
Sir, your name?
Johnson. Harry Johnson. I was just having a look around.
I will be your guide. I trust you will find the lower depths interesting.
Is there anything, well, real down here? I mean, anything that just happened, that wasn't created by...
Pardon, sir?
Offices, corridors, more offices, more corridors.
Follow me, sir.
Just a minute. How far down are we?
27 miles.
27 miles? Is this the lowest level?
If you mean, does the city extend below us? No, it does not, sir.
Then what's down there?
Several miles of insulatory material, sir.
And after that?
Well, sir, if you'll allow me to, whisper...
What's that?
An archaic term that describes the inner core of the planet. That is all. There is nothing more.
I walk. I walk until I come to the end of the city. I walk for days, weeks, months. It doesn't matter how long for. And when the city's finished, there's got to be something real. Something that just happened without man's help.
And Johnson did just that. Harry Johnson walked the city streets. Was Johnson hoping to see a tree? Or a flower, perhaps? Ridiculous thought. Such things belonged in the mists of the shadowy past. The ugly past. But Johnson tried. He had set out upon a quest.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Have you seen anything real? Something that hasn't been, well, made.
What are you talking about? Something that hasn't been made? But again, he was a psychiatrist.
I can't see my psychiatrist. He was made. He's a robot.
Excuse me. Please. I'm looking.
Your name?
Looking. Johnson, Harry Johnson.
Are you a resident of this district?
I'm a traveler. I'm looking for something real.
You've been walking. How far are you going?
Well, as far as I can go. But it's so slow. So slow.
Hire an air car. There's an agency in blocks 10789.
An air car? Yes. Of course. Thank you.
He hadn't thought of that. A man flying in the air must see the end of the city. And at the end of the city, there just had to be... maximum altitude. The city fell away. The buildings, blocks upon blocks, were left behind. After many miles of traveling, Johnson, in his air car, saw a change in the gray jungle of cement below him. The buildings were becoming fewer.
The city's coming to an end. In all my life, I've never been out of the city. The city's ending. Ending!
Harry Johnson craned forward. The thought of what lay ahead sent his heart thumping excitedly. And then, even as the city thinned, another city, even bigger than the last, leapt up to take its place.
At the end of the city, there's just another city.
In agony, Harry Johnson punched the keys of the air car control at random, and the vessel fell to the west. Its occupant no longer cared.
I might as well be dead. I can't go back. Can't live like I've been living in a grey, meaningless world. Oh, please. Want something real. That's all. I want something.
What's that? What had he seen? Harry Johnson had seen a great patch of colour he had never set eyes on in his life before. Green. The air car was approaching a great park.
Down. Down. I've got to see. I knew there was something else. I knew.
The great park exploded across his eyes. He recoiled from the assault of greenery that filled his world. And his finger stabbed at the descent button.
Down.
The tiny vehicle spiraled away and came, eventually, to rest upon a richly carpeted lawn in the middle of the great park. Harry Johnson sat, unmoving, for a long time. And then he climbed out, onto the first grass he had ever seen in his whole unsatisfactory life.
It's beautiful. A park, a gigantic park. I thought man had forgotten. How could any man forget such beauty as this? I can see trees and hills. I'm running through grass. Running in the most beautiful place in the world. A bird. Bird.
That was all. The bird didn't call again. Harry Johnson fell asleep. The lines of worry and boredom etched on his face over many years disappeared as if by magic. The air was pleasantly warm, and he had no thought of danger. His last conscious thought was that his journey of discovery had only just begun.
A bird. I've heard.
He walked for perhaps half a mile and came upon an expanse of water which was not enclosed by concrete.
What is it?
It was a lake.
Those things sailing on all that water. What are they?
On the placid waters sat several creatures with long, graceful necks. They were swans. The man's eyes watered with tears of pleasure. And he ran and ran.
Now I've found something real. I've found 100 things that are real.
And then the man, Harry Johnson, found the rose garden. A furious onslaught of color, the like of which he could never have imagined in his gray city days. Roses and roses and roses. Mile after mile of exotic blooms.
But who looks after all this? Who tends the gardens and the trees and the roses? Someone must.
He was still puzzling over this annoying detail when he came upon the caretaker's cottage. After just a moment of hesitation, Harry knocked.
Come in. You've come to see my park?
That's right. I had no idea that such a place existed. I thought it was all gone. That the cities had swallowed everything.
No, not everything's gone. Some places remain. Parklands like this estate. But not many people come to them anymore.
But why not? It seems inconceivable that anyone would want to stay in the cities when beauty such as this exists on their doorstep.
What is your name?
Harry. Harry Johnson.
What you do not understand, Mr. Johnson, is that most people have forgotten what beauty is. And the rest can't be bothered. You're the first visitor I've had in years.
But surely you don't look after all this yourself?
Heavens no, young man. There are robots. Machines to tend the gardens and the lawns. I'm too old to do anything but sit and wait.
But I didn't see...
Oh, of course you didn't. They do the necessary work by night. Senses such as theirs have no need of the light of day. Prevents them from despoiling the landscape when visitors arrive. Not that it would make much difference these days.
How wise. I couldn't bear to see a machine. All this beauty. Do you live here? All alone?
Where else? I've no need for the cities. The cities have no need of me. Here I can be one with nature. I'm fed and looked after by the machines. A necessary evil, I'm afraid. I don't want for anything. I wish for no more.
I'd like to stay here with you.
Oh, I doubt that would be possible. The city...
Blazes with the city. I don't care what happens to me. What difference does one life here or there matter?
On the contrary, it matters a great deal, Mr. Johnson.
Well, I could apply for permission.
I suppose you could try.
Oh, it's all so wonderful. How did it all begin?
How did what begin,
the city,
Mr. Johnson?
The world, everything. When did we start eating our planet?
Ah, no one knows, my boy. No one knows. Perhaps it was when the gods left Earth and ascended to the stars and closed the gates so that we couldn't follow. We had only one world. What else could we do?
But where will it end?
End? But it has ended, hasn't it? Not very often that I have the chance to converse.
what's happening. It seems to be getting dark. Well, the day can't be ending.
The days were once much longer. It's only out here that they're short. You see, man's changed even the length of the days. He's changed everything.
The old caretaker followed Harry to the open door, smiling. In the doorway was a tremendous rose bush. Scarlet blooms burst hungrily towards the sunlight. A sudden desire swept over the little visitor from the gray city. He stretched out a hand towards the flowers, meaning to pluck one, to carry it with him.
No!
Huh?
You mustn't touch the flowers!
You mustn't touch...
No! I've had enough of orders! This is no place for orders! No!
Harry Johnson lifted the broken flower to his nose and sniffed arrogantly. And even as he did so, the rose withered and died. Dead leaves crumpled into a wraith-like gossamer remnant of a spider's web.
It's not a real flower.
He looked at the old man, and the despair in the caretaker's eyes was the most terrible sight he had ever seen.
No!
And he crouched and with one savage pull wrenched up the whole bush. The whole splendid thing came away easily. Immediately, it withered and died.
They're fakes. The roses are fakes. Plastic. But if the roses are fakes, the whole garden must be a fake. It isn't real. I've been tricked. You filthy liar! You almost had me believing. All I wanted was the truth. You could have given it to me. Only you, and you chose to lie. But why? I should have known. I should have guessed. You're a machine. You're a robot like all the rest, aren't you?
I told you not to pick the rose. I tried to stop you from finding out the truth.
Truth? Truth!
And the old man fell to the ground, and Johnson began to kick him. He kicked with all his strength until the face broke, and the synthetic fibers appeared through the destroyed protoplasm. And then he left the robot, which had seemed to him like a real man. He ran fast away, across the green, false grass, and began to search desperately for the one real bloom, one blossom that hadn't been made by man. He swore and he cried and he wrenched at the wires which held each and every bush fast in the synthetic soil. And the wires scratched his hands, and he laughed as he saw the blood flow from his cut.
Agents from the city. That's what they are. Agents from the city. They followed me. They're going to take me back. Back to the city. The city that covers the world. 27 miles deep. Nothing that really exists. Don't you understand? Robots are so close to humans and humans are so close to robots. It's impossible to tell the difference anymore. Don't you understand? Be the last man in the world. Blood on my hands. See? Blood. I can't go back. I can't go back to the city.
And the air car landed a little distance away. Two figures alighted and slowly made their way towards the man, groveling in the mock, fake grass by the torn, ruined, synthetic flowers. And even as they walked towards him, Harry grabbed at some of the twisted, broken wire and scratched savagely at his wrists until the blood flowed redly and fast from the swollen arteries. He held his wrists aloft and shook them at the approaching figure.
See this? You see it? You blast your machine? I can do something you can never do! I can die!
And the two figures reached Harry and stood and watched him dispassionately. And Harry, crouching on the ground, wondered at their patience and seeming lack of interest. The blood flowed and flowed. And only when the blood had stopped flowing and the false earth had swallowed the last drop of precious fluid, did he comprehend their patience. He stared at his upheld arm and willed the blood to flow afresh. But none gushed forth from the tattered wrist. His veins were empty, already collapsing.
I couldn't tell from the air. I wondered if he was one of them or...
I knew. Look what he's done. All this mess.
Get it over with. Got to get back.
And Harry Johnson still lived. All his blood gone, and yet he still lived. His brain and heart had no need of the blood designed only to fool his conscience and his fellow men. His was the ultimate evolution. A mind that existed independently of his synthetic body. There was nothing real. Not even the man who sought it. There were no tears to express Johnson's grief. His weary body seemed suddenly to split asunder. He sprawled upon the treacherous earth and, with his face buried in the lying grass, wept for the passing of all things real.
Come on, don't waste time. Get it over with.
And he never even felt the narrow shaft that entered his chest and cancelled his soulless life.
You have just been listening to Quest by Lee Harding, brought to you by Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder. Quest was adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe. Listen again next Friday night at 9:30 to SF68.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Protective Service, Jim Martin speaking.
Hello. Hello, Martin. I can't hear you at all, so get this straight.
What?
This is the Del Cass secretary to Joe Girard, the diamond merchant. They killed him, and I'm bound hand and foot.
Go on, go on. I'm listening.
I heard you say something, but I can't make out what it was. I managed to push the receiver off of my chin, but I can't hold it to my ear.
Go ahead. I understand.
You know the address. 45 Fulton Place. Bring the police. I'll try to get free.
We'll be there right away. Goodbye.
Oh, thank heavens you're here, Mr. Martin.
And this is Lieutenant Garfield of the police.
How do you do, Miss Cass? Jim, do you want to go look at the body?
Let's get the story first. I couldn't get much on the phone.
Tell us what happened, Miss Cass.
I will in a minute. I'm a little shaken. I just managed to get the rope off.
Now, please, Miss Cass, time is very important.
Mr. Garfield, I knew it would happen.
Why?
Well, he always carried a packet of diamonds in the inside pocket of his jacket.
Did they take it?
Yes.
When did it happen?
Well, about 8. Mr. Girard asked me to work late tonight. He was dictating a letter when... I can hardly bear to think of it.
Go on, Miss Cass.
Two men, they walked in and they grabbed us both and one of them bound me up. I couldn't move.
What did they use to kill Girard?
The metal stool. They hit him over the head because he struggled so.
Yes, yes, go on.
The blood rushed from his veins. It was horrible.
And the diamonds?
He must have been dead or nearly dead. They opened his jacket. It was his new double-breasted blue suit, and they took the packet from his inner pocket.
And you phoned me right away?
Well, as soon as I could wriggle over to the desk and get the receiver off the hook.
Let's have a look at the body.
Oh, it was horrible. Just horrible.
Miss Cass, I thought you said they unbuttoned his jacket.
Well, they did. Then they buttoned it before they left.
Oh, I see. And it was a man and a woman?
No, two men. The faces were covered, but I know they were men.
All right, Cass, come across. Where did you hide the diamonds?
What are you talking about?
Just this, Miss Cass. I arrest you for the murder of Joseph Girard.
Where did Adele Cass slip up in her murder and robbery? There are two clues. Do you know them? In a moment, Jim Martin and Lieutenant Garfield will tell us. But first...
I feel like a new man. It's a lovely day today.
I thought you had flu.
I took a grandpa headache powder, and I'm well better.
When colds and flu are about, grandpa headache powders are what you need. Grandpa headache powders work fast because they dissolve almost immediately. Grandpa makes all those dreadful flu symptoms disappear quickly. So, whenever you're in pain, get fast relief. Get grandpa headache powder.
Ah, grandpa.
Now, let's see if you're as observant as Jim Martin and Lieutenant Garfield.
You're crazy. Why, Mr. Martin himself heard me on the phone.
That was your first mistake, Miss Cass. If you were really bound hand and foot, you couldn't have dialed the Martin Protective Service. Your second error, Miss Cass, was insisting that two men committed the murder. Right, Martin?
That's absolutely right.
You see, Miss Cass, a man buttons a coat or jacket left side over right. A woman buttons it right over left. Joe Girard's jacket was buttoned by a woman, right over left. And that woman, Miss Cass, was you.
Next up is one of the half-hour episodes of Ripley's Believe It or Not. This particular one is from January the 1st of 1935. I really enjoy listening to and playing for you this really old stuff. It's like finding a time machine. So, if you'll join hands, we'll all follow Mr. Peabody into the way back.
Believe it or not. The Baker's Broadcast, presented in behalf of the 30,000 bakers in the United States and Canada, with Ozzie Nelson and his orchestra, and, believe it or not, Robert Ripley.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ozzie Nelson. We're answering your many kind requests and playing our old favorite, Rigmarole. We'll be right back.
Robert Ripley will give you thrills high in the air, some of the strangest and most daring aeronautical feats ever recorded. Tonight we have as an added guest one of the greatest flyers of all, Mr.
Wait a minute, Ben. Now, that's my job.
Well, okay. Excuse me, Bob. Here he is, believe it or not, Robert Ripley.
Greetings, everybody.
Hello, Ozzie.
Hello, Bob. Glad to see you. What's all this airplane business? The China Clipper get you?
Yes, sir, Ozzie. I think the flight of the China Clipper is one of the greatest ever made. Imagine it. 16,000 miles over the ocean.
Yeah, but seagulls have been doing it for years.
Oh, no, they haven't. No, they haven't. Believe it or not, Ozzy, man has learned more about flying in the last 20 years than birds have ever learned since they've worn feathers. Man can fly higher, faster, longer than any bird that ever flapped a wing. No bird ever flew as high as Kukanaki, the Russian, who flew 9 miles straight up in the air only 2 weeks ago. No bird ever flew as long as the Key Brothers of Mississippi, who stayed in the air constantly for more than 27 days. And no bird ever flew as fast as Lieutenant Argello when he piloted his plane at the terrific speed of 441 miles an hour over Lake Garda a year ago. And besides, man can do barrel rolls, tail spins, loop-the-loop, fly upside down and through snow, sleet, fog, and rain. And so, believe it or not, Ozzy, the birds should be taking lessons from our aviators, believe it or not. Now, do you realize, Ozzy, how fast Lieutenant Argello was going when he flew 441 miles an hour?
Almost as fast as a bullet, I'd say.
He was going faster than a bullet. He was actually traveling at the rate of 638 feet a second. And a bullet from a policeman's revolver travels only 600 feet a second. So Argello would be perfectly safe. Because such a bullet could never catch up with him, he could actually overtake it and, by reaching out his hand, pick it right out of the air.
Strange things they do in the air these days.
And strange sights you see in the air, too, Ozzy. You know, a question often asked me is, what is the most beautiful sight on Earth? Well, I think the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in all my travels was a triple circular rainbow, which I saw 10,000 feet in the air.
Well, what's a triple circular rainbow?
Rainbows that are completely round, Ozzy. They're really rain circles, not rainbows. All rainbows appear circular from an airplane. On this occasion, I was flying over the Amazon River when three brilliant rainbows appeared one inside the other. Words cannot describe the sheer beauty of this brilliant spectacle. And in the center of the innermost circle was the shadow of our airplane. We floated along with this heavenly sight below us for several hours, the shadow of the plane always remaining in the exact center, always the same size.
The shadow always the same size? How could that be, Bob?
Well, you see, the sun is so far from the earth that no matter how high or low an airplane flies, its shadow remains the same size, whether it's 10 feet or 10,000 feet in the air.
Gee, that's interesting. I've always wanted to do more flying myself.
Well, I guess everybody does, Ozzy. I'd like to tell you about one man who wanted to fly more than anything else in the world. Let me draw you a radio sketch. It happened in 1926, just 9 years ago. The scene is an oil field in Seminole, Oklahoma. Two men are talking as they work over the repair anvils, forging chains.
Hey, buddy, watch those chips flying. They're white hot.
Yeah, I'm watching them.
Boy, that one just missed it. Better be careful, bud. If your face tops one of those chips, it'll be just too bad. Dangerous work, son.
I've been in tougher spots, though.
Yeah, timekeeper said something about you being an aviator. And I'm blaming you for quitting.
I haven't quit. I'm only taking time out to make some money. As soon as I've saved enough, I'm buying my own plane.
Never had one of your own, huh?
No, but I will someday. I'm going to save my money, and when I get enough, it's going to be goodbye oil field.
Take you a little while to do it on what you're making here, won't it, bud?
No, I don't know. Saw a second-hand plane over at the airport today. It's a honey. Canadian Jenny that I could have bought for $1,500 if I'd have had it.
This flying's kind of got you, son, ain't it?
Got me? Brother, I'd give my right eye to own a plane of my own.
Hey, you bought that airplane yet?
What?
That Jenny you were talking about yesterday.
Oh, no. Not yet. What a ship. She needs a little fixing up, but she's got plenty of what it takes. I went over again last night to take another look at her. I can just see her painted up and soaring through the sky.
Watch out! Oh, ow. What is it? What is it?
My,
let me see.
It.
Let me see. Get your hand
I
away.
I can't see.
Gosh, you're full of blood. Hey, you guys, get a doctor right away. Okay, bud. How is it? Any easier now?
I can't see a thing.
Take it easy now. Take it easy.
Hey, what's the matter?
Fella here just hurt his eye.
His eye?
Yeah.
Hey, who is it?
Hello there.
Oh. Oh, you're the fellow who was here looking at that Jenny plane. Say, what's the matter with your eye?
Had a little accident over at the oil field.
Oh, gosh, that's too bad.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. The day before the accident, I said I'd give my right eye to own this plane. Well, I gave my left eye instead.
What do you mean?
The day after I made that crack, I had this accident and collected $1,800 compensation for my eye. Got a bill of sale for that ship?
Yeah, but say, are you going to try to fly with one eye?
Let me worry about that, brother. Someday with that one eye, I'm going to fly around the world.
Well, that's a luck to you, bud. Yeah, here's a bill of sale. Now, wait till I get my pen. Ah, there we are. Now, what's your name?
Post.
And what's your first name?
Wiley.
Wiley Post.
That is exactly how Wiley Post acquired his first airplane. Fate took him at his word and deprived him of his eye, but gave him a plane which started him on a career that included his astounding, record-breaking, round-the-world flight. Believe it or not. In your walk, a little bit independent. In your talk, there's nothing like you in Paris or New York. You're awfully easy on the eyes, a little bit independent. When we dance, a little bit independent towards romance. A bit of sophistication in your glance, and yet you're easy on the eyes. Whenever I'm with you alone, you weave a magic spell. And though it be a danger zone, I only know that you're swell. A little bit independent with your smile, a little bit independent in your style. But how can I help but love you all the while when you're so easy on the eye? Have you any more good believe it or nots about flyers?
Well, I think I have a real hair raiser. It's about the luckiest man alive. He's Captain Headley, an American aviator. During the war, Headley was a machine gunner in a fighting plane piloted by Jimmy Makepeace of Canada. Due to a misunderstanding of signals, Makepeace put the plane into a nosedive so quickly that Headley was thrown out of the plane 10,000 feet in the air. Death never seemed more certain. He thought the end had come as he fell end over end 300 feet through space when suddenly he landed on the tail of his own airplane as it came out of the nosedive and a little while later was safe again on land, believe it or not.
This flying business sounds like it's all it's cracked up to be.
Yes, and now let me tell you an amazing incident concerning two world-famous flyers, Clyde Pangborn and Hugh Herndon. In July 1931, they landed in Japan on a flight from Siberia and were promptly arrested for taking pictures. When they were released a couple of weeks later, they were ordered to leave Japan immediately.
Well, what did they do, Bob?
They decided to go back to the United States as quickly as they could by making a non-stop flight across the Pacific Ocean. On October the 3rd, the two aviators took off from Samashiro Beach and pointed the nose of their heavily loaded Balanca monoplane toward home. But they'd only gone about 200 miles when Pangborn and Herndon began to exchange glances of grim significance.
We can't get any altitude, Clyde. I guess 1,000 gallons are too much for this buggy.
And look at that fog ahead of us.
Yeah. I'm afraid we'll never get above it with this load. How about it? Shall we turn back for Japan?
Yeah, and spend the rest of our lives in jail. We got to do something to lighten this ship, and pretty quick.
Well, what can we let go? We haven't anything but gas and oil.
Yeah, I know. How about the landing gear?
Our wheels?
Yeah.
Yeah, but how are we going to land without wheels?
Yeah, we'll have to take a chance on that, Hugh. If we don't drop them, it means crashing here into the sea.
Yeah, and if we do drop them, it may mean cracking up when we try to land. If we ever see land again.
Yeah, well, that's the point. We've got 5,000 miles to go before we have to worry about that. Well, what do you say? Goodbye, wheels?
Okay, Clyde.
All right. Here goes the lever.
There they go. Dropping like bombs into the ocean.
Yep. We'll never see them again.
Hey, look, Clyde. We're climbing. It's worked.
You're right. Nothing to worry about now but crossing the Pacific.
Half hours later, Pangborn and Herndon had successfully spanned the Pacific Ocean.
Boy, old Mount Rainier looked pretty good to me back there, didn't it to you?
Well, I'd say it did.
Say, you?
Yeah?
How much gas left?
It's nearly gone. Where would you say we were?
Well, figuring from the time we passed over Seattle, I'd say we were somewhere near Wenatchee.
Well, that's your hometown, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a swell place to crash.
Yeah, that's just what I don't like about it.
Listen, Clyde, we're practically out of gas and the fog's getting worse. How well do you know this country?
Yeah, like the palm of my hand.
Well, what do you say?
I say landings have been made before without wheels. It's now or never. What do you say, kid?
Okay, Clyde. Let her go.
Boy, that was a little narrow.
I'll say so. But we made it.
Yep. Huey, we're here.
Yeah. Well, let's get out of here and see how much damage you've done.
Yeah, all right. Now then.
Well, propeller's bent a little, but outside of that, the ship seems okay.
Yeah. Hey, look at the gang coming.
Hey, yeah. Pop! What? What's my brother? What, Craig?
Clyde, Lord Fellow, am I glad to
Craig.
See you.
Well, you old so-and-so. Say, how'd you know I was coming? Look here, what's all that crowd for?
Well, the newspapers have been full of you in Herndon.
Yeah?
I took a wild guess you'd try to make Wenatchee, and we're here. It's over there in the crowd.
She's here, too. Come on, let's go over.
Well, in a minute. Got to have your pictures taken first.
Oh, no.
Say,
huh?
What happened to your wheel?
Ship was too heavy, and we had to drop them overboard.
Oh, we've had lots of fun.
Yeah.
You know about the Japs putting us in jail, I suppose.
Yeah, we read about it.
Say, we want to never want to see another Japanese as long as we live, do we, Hugh?
Not for a while, anyhow. Well, that's just too bad, Clyde, because there's one here now.
Huh?
He's here especially to see you, boy.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's stall him off, will you, while we run.
Hey, now, wait a minute. Come here, Mr. Kobayashi.
Mr. Pangborn, Mr. Herndon.
Yes?
Gentlemen, I represent the Japanese newspaper Asahi. Huh? I take pleasure in congratulating you on your record-breaking flight, and hereby present you with a check of $25,000.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Kobe. Thank you very much.
What was that you said about never wanting to see a Japanese again, Clyde?
Skip it, first.
And now, The scene changes to an automobile supply store in Seattle. It's 17 months later. We find the captain of a small fishing boat talking to the dealer.
Say, have you found out anything yet about that tire I brought in here?
Yes, I've been in touch with the factory. It's one of our company's tires, all right.
Well, what's it worth?
Just a minute, Deb. Would you mind telling me again just how you found that tire?
Sure, it was floating in the water just a few miles out of Seattle, off Cape Flattery.
Cape Flattery? Captain, I've got a surprise for you. Do you know that this tire is from the plane in which Pangborn and Herndon made their trans-Pacific flight?
And it was the same wheel that was dropped from the plane off the coast of Japan and was carried by the ocean current 5,000 miles across the Pacific, where it was picked up by this fishing boat captain within 100 miles of the exact spot where Pangborn and Herndon landed on the Pacific coast, believe it or not. And now I have a real surprise for you. Let me introduce the man whose story you have just heard. The only man to make a nonstop flight over both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and one of the outstanding flyers in the history of aviation, Mr. Clyde Pangborn.
By the way, Mr. Pangborn, have you figured in any more believe-it-or-not incidents like the one Bob just told us about the tire?
Well, there's one I always think of when people tell me that flying is dangerous.
What's that one about?
This happened back in 1924 on a routine flight I was making with Aaron Kranz. We got caught in a severe thunderstorm, and something went wrong with our motor, and before we knew it, the plane was on fire.
Gosh, what did you do?
Kranz did everything he could to lighten the plane so he wouldn't land with too much of a crash, and do you know one of the first things he threw out of the ship?
What?
His parachute.
His parachute?
Yes, anyway, we landed and cracked up a bit, but crawled out of the plane perfectly intact. Kranz and I ran to a tree to get out of the rain, congratulating ourselves on the closest escape we'd ever experienced. I tell you, nothing ever looked so good as that nice, safe tree.
Terra firma seemed pretty good to you, eh?
Yeah, until lightning struck the tree.
What?
Yep, we were under it only a second when a bolt of lightning came crashing down right on top of us.
Gosh, out of the flying plane and into the fire.
And since then, I've been satisfied to take the air, which I think I'll do right now. So long.
So long. Quicker than you can say, Jack Robin. And I'm going to sing the vocal chorus. In fact, I like to stick to safe things like singing vocal chorus. Than you can say, Jack Robinson, you can say, I love you. And wouldn't you rather say, I love you, than Jack Robinson? Quicker than you can walk around the block, you can be kissing me. And wouldn't you rather be kissing me than walk around the block? 60 minutes make an hour. 3 feet make a yard. 30 days are in September. And if you wanna know, statistics show, quicker than you can say, Jack Robinson, you can say, I love you. And wouldn't you rather say, I love you, than Jack Robinson?
Scene, a restaurant. The cast, Mr. and Mrs. John Ferguson. Enter a waiter.
What would you like to have, madam?
Oh, I don't know what I want to eat. Jim, what are you having?
Well, I think I'll have a hot roast beef sandwich.
I didn't know you liked hot roast beef sandwiches. Well, if I'd known that, we'd have had them at home lots of times. They make it two, waiter.
Thank you, madam.
Yes, everyone likes hot meat sandwiches. Serve them often for lunches and cold weather suppers. And when your family wants to eat just bread and gravy, let them have it. We now realize that bread is much more of an all-around food than many of us used to think. When you don't have gravy, a good way to serve hot meat sandwiches is to put the meat between slices of toast, cover with cream sauce and grated cheese, and bake a few minutes in the oven. While you're buying bread this week, be sure to get some fruitcake. And don't wait until Christmas to eat it. Have fruitcake often these days. Right up till New Year's, delicious fruitcake is your baker's special, his cake of the month.
And now let me say goodnight to you, as the Japanese said to Pangborn and Herndon when they took off on their trans-Pacific flight. Although the Japanese didn't mean it. They're very polite, you know. But they crossed their hands in their sleeves and bowed low and bumped their heads on the ground and said, Sayonara. Let thy steps be slow and steady, that thou stumble not.
The announcer is Ben Brown. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Well, that's the end, folks. Pretty much the end. I do want to thank you for showing up. I do want to suggest that if you have an old radio program that you like and would like to hear again, let me know. I'll see if I can find it. I mean, it should be in the vein of what I do here. It shouldn't be something with continuing characters. I very rarely do that. Actually, the only thing I can think of off the top of my head is the Avengers, just to prove that I'm not that stodgy. My preference would be that it be from an anthology. It doesn't have to be from one we've played. It should be horror or mystery or science fiction, some kind of thriller. After all, that is what we do here. You can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can drop by the web where I keep the show notes for each and every show. There's a way to contact me there. There's a entry in the navigation menu for contacts. A relatively new thing is the blog. Easiest way to find that, too, is to go to www.nighttransmissions.com. All right. I'm going to shut up now for sure.